Greetings, greetings once again to all my enemies and all my friends. That's right, it's the Weekly Worldview, and I am your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. It's the show where we don't take calls. We don't tolerate sponsors, but we do help focus you on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. And this week, here at the McBurney Compound, we have discovered that when you are engaged in one of your primary responsibilities is sorting through various foods to try to isolate your dog's food allergy, you know you're living the good life. That's right. That's one of our main goals here over the past few days, trying to isolate what exactly is the dog allergic to, which I must tell you was never a concern in the McBurney household as I was growing up. What is the dog allergic to? That was never an issue, but it is an issue now. And it's an issue of some import. And we hope to get to the bottom of it and then issue a report.
What if it's allergic to goat?
Yeah, if the dog is allergic to goat droppings, that's going to be a problem. But anyway, let's get to some of the news because we've got equally important pressing news coming in from around the world. From netshark.com, a young man named Makani Tran was attending the Pokemon Tournament of Champions. I wasn't aware there was such a thing, but there is. Talk about living the good life. If you're attending the Pokemon Tournament of Champions, you're living the good life. Makani Tran, young man, took time off school, spent $800 of his own money to participate in the Pokemon Tournament of Champions, apparently the global, perhaps even the intergalactic championship. And he was being questioned before the tournament began by one of the judges and found himself disqualified. Uh-oh. Because he violated the Pokemon International Tournament of Champions inclusion policy by making someone feel unsafe and uncomfortable. What exactly happened? Well, the kid was asked by the judge what his preferred pronouns were, and the kid laughed. Oh. That's right. He laughed at the idea that he would have preferred pronouns. And for that, the young man was kicked out of the tournament. Uh-huh. That's good for him is exactly right.
But he's a gamer.
Well, there's worse things, I suppose, you could squander your life on than Pokemon, although a squandering it is either way. But anyway, after the kid laughed, and the kid only laughed because it's stupid. Mm-hmm. It's not because he's a bad kid. It's not because he's rebelling. It's because if you ask me what my preferred pronouns are, it strikes me as stupid, and so I laugh. And so he's a normal kid. And after he laughed, the judge said, "I just wanted to check to be safe. I go by they, them, so don't be a jerk about it."
No way.
Yeah, he actually said this to a teenage kid, if you could believe that. Yeah. So the judge kicked the kid out because the judge didn't feel safe because the kid laughed. So that's the thing. Normal people make mentally deranged people feel unsafe. But we're going to talk about some things on the show today that show which foot that shoe is on, as a matter of fact. Who should feel unsafe? Should it be the gender confused, sexually fluid, criminally insane? Or should it be the normal people? Who exactly should be concerned here? Well, we'll get to some of that. Meanwhile, Mayor Eric Adams, he's the mayor in New York who ran as the law and order candidate And this is a sign of the times of how far New York City has fallen into degeneracy, is that Eric Adams ran as the law and order man. He is now saying that he has uncovered the source of the 30-some-odd percent spike in auto thefts in New York City over the past, well, however long, at least since he's been mayor. Did I say governor or mayor? I hope I said mayor. He's the mayor. Although it's all the same thing. He's the executive in charge of a geographic area known as New York City, Gotham. He says that the 32% increase in car thefts on his watch can be directly attributed to TikTok. Specifically, the Kia Challenge on TikTok, which is a video that shows how to steal Kia and Hyundai cars. So there's a video on TikTok that shows how to steal a car or several types of cars. And it's called the Kia Challenge. And Eric Adams says that's to blame for the 30-some-odd percent increase in auto thefts that have taken place on his watch. And first of all, the idea that there could be a video online how to steal a car, that, well, I suppose that just shows how hard it is to catch criminals online. Because you would think that if you put up a video how to steal a car, that the police would kick down your door and arrest you for advocating criminal activity. But maybe it's hard to find them. No, maybe they're not even looking. In fact, that might be the source of the problem, Mayor Adams. It's not the fact that there's a video online how to steal a car. It's that nobody's enforcing justice anymore. And kids feel like they can make a video on how to steal a car, and they can put it online because they're not afraid. Because everything criminal has been legalized. So, you know, if getting high is legal, how can stealing a car not be legal? And eventually, Mayor Adams and the rest of you, you're going to have to answer that question. Well, why is stealing a car illegal? And you're not going to have an answer. Because there is no answer outside of an objective morality based on the Creator God. And you refuse to go there. We can't go there. And if you don't go there, Mr. Adams, somebody's going to steal your car. And eventually, you're not even going to have an argument against why it was wrong that they stole your car. And so you're all heading there, careening, barreling there at 90 miles an hour toward that day. And when you get there, Mr. Adams, hopefully there will be a Christian around to give you a ride, because you won't have a car. Okay, and now speaking of justice, we go to the Just a System file, where Matthew Perry has been sentenced to 3,000 years in prison. Not that Matthew Perry. That Matthew Perry is not this Matthew Perry. There's a famous Matthew Perry. There is. And so when I read the name, I thought, I've heard of that guy. And I thought it was the guy from 90210. But it turns out it was a guy from another show called Friends. So that Matthew Perry is not this Matthew Perry. This Matthew Perry has been sentenced to 3,000 years in prison. That Matthew Perry from that show, he's just a little overweight and getting wrinkles. I mean, just like the rest of us. This particular Matthew Perry here, he was convicted. Now listen to this. If you want to know how ridiculous and ludicrous and laughable the justice system has become, and why the children are all just laughing at it and posting videos on how to steal your Kia, Matthew Perry was convicted of 13,143 felony counts of crimes against children, including, get this, 2,190 counts of rape.
What?
2,190 charges, I'm sorry, counts of rape of a child under the age of 13. So he was convicted of 2,190 counts of rape. How is that possible? I don't know how that's even possible, but it has happened. And so, having been convicted of over 2,000 counts of rape, he's sentenced to 3,000 years in prison. 3,000 years. At which any child at the age of 13, hell-bent on deviant behavior, just laughs. 3,000 years. 2,000 counts of rape. It's all ridiculous. There are no penalties, is what our justice system is teaching the children, especially the cunning and devious young male children. That's what they're being taught. And there is going to be hell to pay for this. When a kid can look up and say a guy can rape 2,000 people, and then a judge sentences him to a ridiculous 3,000 years, it's obvious to the cunning and devious, black-hearted 13-year-old boy plotting the next disaster that this is all a joke. But the prosecutor in this case issued a statement. The prosecutor said, quote, "I am proud to announce that Matthew Perry will have to live for 3,000 years in order to pay his debt to society. And now I would like to go get back to fulfilling my promise to the people of my community to continue cleaning up the corruption here in Greene County," says the prosecutor. So he's obviously running for office. Greene County, North Carolina, Alabama, somewhere. Greene County could be any state in the United States. It doesn't really matter where it is. The district attorney sentences a serial rapist, and 2,000 is beyond serial, isn't it? It's astronomically criminal. To rape 2,000 people and be allowed to live is just unbelievable. But the prosecutor he gets the 3,000-year sentence. Because that's how success in prosecution is measured, in how many years and how many deals and how many convictions. It's all just a racket. And it's all a racket around running for office. That's what district attorneys and prosecutors are. They're politicians in training. This guy's now running for office. And by the way, one of the hallmarks of America's self-destruction will be that the administration of justice became the favored political stepping stone of the politician, virtually ensuring rule by lawyers. The fact that the DA has his eye on the governor's office all the time virtually ensures that we will all one day be by lawyers, which is where we are now. Rule by lawyers, which leads directly to tyranny, which leads directly to calamity, which is what we're on the edge of right now. Dancing around just the edges. Speaking of dancing around the edges, Jacob Chansley, the so-called January 6th, what do they call him? They call him the QAnon shaman. He had the red, white, and blue face paint and the buffalo horns and the bare chest with the tattoos and all of that. He was the face of the insurrection. Could barely navigate his way around the halls of the Capitol without the help of the Capitol Police, who let him in and all that. Anyway, he's been released from prison to a halfway house. And many of us, when we first read this, we thought, well, you know, finally, we all stood up and said, this is outrageous that this guy's been, and they've let him go, so we're having some impact. But no, that's not the case. Jake's lawyer says, for the record, Jake is out on schedule. This is how it was all planned to be. And according to the paperwork there at the Bureau of Prisons, this is just when Chansley was supposed to get out. The lawyer said, I didn't do anything extraordinary, to which we all said, yeah, you're not kidding, you didn't do anything extraordinary. Anyway, it just turns out it's not a victory for anyone. Not the guy in the buffalo horns, not the lawyer, not justice, not America, not truth, justice in the American way. It's not a victory. It's just another random act in a mindless system. That's right. And we had all just forgotten that typically even a real criminal only does a fraction of their time. Weekly Worldview, and I am your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. Thank you for sticking with us, folks. We've got the release of the J6 Shaman. No, the QAnon Shaman, but no sign that that's justice for anyone, unfortunately. But it's the best. That's maybe the best news of the week. Maybe. Well, it is Easter week. It's Resurrection week. That's something. Today is, I forget what the Catholics start with on Sunday. So I'm not up on my holidays. I just know that it's Resurrection week and next Sunday is Easter. So happy whatever today is with the Catholics. They have a thing.
I don't know.
I think this is the triumphal entry day, I think. I don't know. I really don't get into all of that, but so this is a week when even the secular world gives lip service to Jesus Christ, except for the maniacal trannies. They do not get into any of it. They don't do any of it. And so we'll get to some of that. But first, let's go to the I don't know what to call it. It's the deep conspiracy revealed. So since I was a teenager, there have been people telling me that it's actually the police and the CIA who are smuggling all the drugs into America. When I thought it was criminals intent on making as much money as possible, other people have been telling me, no, Doug, it's the CIA, it's the police and the CIA. Because that's how they make their living. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The drugs come in, you need the cops, the yada yada, right? And so I always thought that was all just crazy talk. Because this is America. I mean, the government and the police, they're not the ones smuggling the drugs. Dateline San Jose, California, from the Washington Examiner. Joanne Segovia has been arrested after using her personal and office computers to order thousands of opioids that were shipped into the United States. She was arrested for conspiracy to distribute opioids across the United States. Starting in July 2019, officers intercepted and opened five of the shipments and found thousands and thousands of opioid pills. Oh, by the way, she's the executive director of the San Jose Police Union. Okay, so, I mean, technically she's not a member of the government or the police. She's just an associate of both and an executive in high position. So, anyway, so there you have it. The San Jose Police Union executive director has been smuggling opioids into the country for distribution around the country. And what I noticed here was that for over 3 years, she was allowed to operate. Uh-huh. Like police and investigators started intercepting her drugs 3 years ago. So she was allowed to operate. What? Why? I mean, was she only arrested because she misgendered someone just recently and that was the final straw? Was the smuggling of the opioids, was that not enough to, I mean, smuggling drugs apparently is just all in a day's work for a deep state bureaucrat. Although she's not technically a member of the actual state, it's the police union executive. That's right. Smuggling, that's all in a day's work, but failure to follow pronoun policy will not be tolerated. We had to finally take her down. But seriously, I mean, does it take 3 years to make a case when you've intercepted the smuggled drugs and you've got the pills? Are our authorities that incompetent that it takes them 3 years to build the case? I mean, they could say, well, we were looking for bigger fish. And so, okay, but I mean, 3 months maybe maximum. If you're actually doing an investigation, how long does it take to find the bigger fish, for crying out loud? People are actually getting killed with these opioids that she's smuggling in. They're actually killing people. But for three, it took them 3 years, 2019, July of 19, 2021, 22, So 3.5 years, for crying out loud. They let her smuggle in pills. It's almost as if it wasn't that big of a deal to them. I don't know. It's strange. Very strange. It almost makes you want to join the John Birch Society and subscribe to their magazine. And because, well, they're the ones who told me that it's actually the cops and the CIA that are importing all the drugs. And the America you believe in, that's been over for, well, since before your lifetime, young man. Don't be a fool. And I don't know. I just don't dismiss those things as quickly and easily as I did at one time. That's all. Guess I'll say now. Meanwhile, the heir apparent to the shiny toothed, nice haired, the guy out in California, the nephew in the criminal family that runs the state of California, I forget his name, Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom had an heir apparent. Gavin Newsom had an heir apparent being groomed down in San Diego. Groomed, I say. Yeah, probably literally, right? In the modern vernacular, being groomed. Anyway, Nathan Fletcher had the hair. He had the teeth. He had the political pedigree. He was the heir apparent. And I say was because, well, here's what happened. And this is, if you're young and you're just getting into politics, write this one down because this is a classic turn of events. Let's see. Monday, San Diego, the 27th. Was that Monday? Whatever. Anyway, March 27th, San Diego County Supervisor Nathan the Flincher Fletcher. That's right. Nathan Fletcher had earned the local moniker of Flincher because of how many times he flinched in the face of COVID and Black Lives Matter and the trans movement. The guy was a flincher. That's all. So San Diego County Supervisor on the 27th of March, Nathan Fletcher, announced he was checking himself into rehab for post-traumatic stress disorder complicated by alcohol abuse. Yeah, that's right. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, Nathan the Fletcher was one of the nation's most strident and tyrannical COVID hysterics. And he flinched before the leftists. He flinched before the COVID. He flinched before the queers. He was a leftist, queer-hugging, dirt-worshipping communist, heir apparent to Gavin Newsom. As soon as Gavin Newsom is elevated and installed as the president, Nathan Fletcher was the next one who was going to run for governor, apparently. And unfortunately issued a statement on the 27th saying he's been suffering from post-traumatic stress associated with his combat experience, intense childhood trauma, just in case you already hadn't welled up a tear. And then that, of course, has been exacerbated by unintentional alcohol abuse. That's right. Uh-huh. And by Sunday night, you could have heard all the timers being set, waiting for the other shoe to drop. For those of us who've been following politics for a while, when a Democrat politician voluntarily checks himself into rehab, just set your timer, because it's typically about a 72-hour period, and then, thump, the other shoe drops. And here's what happened on March 30th for Nathan the Flincher, Fletcher, heir apparent to the next president of the United States, Gavin Newsom. San Diego County Supervisor Nathan Fletcher is the subject of a lawsuit filed by a former employee alleging sexual assaults. Oh! And additional accusations of improper behavior, as if the sexual assault weren't enough. And then Fletcher then announced that he would resign from the Board of Supervisors and focus on his health and his family. because that's not where his focus was before. It was not on his health and it was not on his family. His focus was on the governor's mansion and acquiring as and exercising and lording it over as many people, as much political power as possible. That's all Nathan Fletcher was thinking about. And on the way, he assaulted, abused, molested, and otherwise engaged with a number of women other than his wife. And then now he's resigning and all of that.
I wonder if he's repentant.
Well, that's what maybe he'll be repentant. Sometimes that's what it takes. You have to be knocked down out of the perch, you know. And so anyway, the fact that he was merely cheating on his wife consensually, I mean, not with his wife's consent, although she hasn't given an interview. We don't know. I mean, after all, they're Democrats. So it's possible he was cheating on his wife with his wife's consent because the acquisition of political power and all that was part of the whole deal. But apparently, according to Fletcher, all of the other women were consenting, and these lies they're telling about assault and pressure and that he was their boss and he had all of that. None of that's true as far as Fletcher can recall, but keep in mind he was drunk at the time. So just in case there is any evidence of any type of assault that comes out, Mr. Fletcher wants us all to keep in mind that he had been drinking heavily at the time. And so, what does all this mean? Nathan Fletcher is still the heir apparent to Governor Gavin Newsom out there in California. Because if I'm not mistaken, Gavin Newsom went through something very similar to this not that long ago.
Oh, really?
Yes, he did. Before he overwhelmingly won the recall election in approximately 35 seconds of ballot counting, Gavin Newsom was declared the current and future and reigning and perhaps the eternal governor of California. He may be the first governor of California allowed to be president at the same time, but they just won't let him go in California. They still want him as their governor because of all of the aforementioned things that Nathan Fletcher is suffering through right now that apparently don't matter that much anymore. All right. Speaking of things that aren't like they were before, I want to draw your attention to a story from the BBC. U.S. journalist Evan Gershkovich has been arrested in Russia by the Russians. And he's been accused of being a spy by the Russians. That's right. The BBC says he's actually an experienced Russian reporter. And the BBC tells us that the White House has condemned his detention. That's right. The White House has condemned the detention of U.S. journalist Evan Gershkovich, leading to skepticism about Gershkovich's innocence. That's right. So this is what I meant. Things aren't like they were before. When the Russians arrest an American journalist and the White House steps out immediately and condemns it, you immediately start thinking, well, maybe the guy's guilty of spying on the Russians because this is how things have changed. The BBC reports that the Kremlin claims they caught him red-handed and they have evidence that he was a spy for the Americans against the Russians. BBC's Russian editor describes Evan Gershkovich as an excellent reporter and a highly principled journalist, at which point that leads to further skepticism about the innocence. Now it's not just skepticism. Now the BBC's taken up for the guy. So now it's skepticism bordering on suspicion that there's a good chance that U.S. journalist Evan Gershkovich is actually a spy. And then Anthony Blinken comes out and says he's deeply concerned and that he sought access to Mr. Gershkovich but has not gotten any response from the Russians, at which point you say, well, wait a minute, why would the Russians give you access, Mr. Blinken? You've declared war on the Russians. They're at war with you right now, or you're at war with them. And why are the Russians not responding to Anthony Blinken? Well, number one, NATO has declared war on Russia. And number two, Anthony Blinken is a panty waste. And Putin sees him as a mere amusement and just laughs at him. Like his boss, Joe Biden. Russia's FSB claims the journalist had collected information classified as a state secret about the activities of Russian defense operations and enterprises. Perhaps in the Ukraine, perhaps not. We are not going to say. Well, what do you say to this? I mean, since NATO is at war with Russia and the United States is NATO, well, the journalist here, Evan Gershkovich, he's a citizen of an enemy combatant, and there's a pretty good case to be made that spying was going on. Here's the thing. I'm willing to at least hear the Russians out on it. That's all. And I can't believe I'm saying that because, I mean, in the past, if the Russians detained an American, you immediately knew it was the Russians who were in the wrong. But now, nobody's so sure anymore. It's the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney, and we have gone from the frying pan into the fire, so to speak. Why would I, a patriotic ex-Marine, I'm an American. I'm a red-blooded American. I'm a red-blooded, God-fearing, patriotic American, and I love America. Why would I suspect that the Russians might be on the right side of any argument against the American government? How could that be? Say it ain't so, Joe. Well, here's one reason. This article is from the Gateway Pundit. Meme maker Douglas Mackey has been found guilty in America by a jury of attempting to deprive individuals from exercising their sacred right to vote. And if you've been following the story, you know that during the 2016 election, Douglas Mackey created a meme encouraging Hillary voters to vote by text. Avoid the line, vote by text, he put up on social media, at which point everybody laughed. And nobody actually thought they could vote by text. How do we know that? Because the government didn't introduce anyone whose vote was altered by the meme. Not one single person. And so, there. What more need be said? How could this guy be convicted? How could that possibly happen in America? Well, it just happened. The verdict came down in New York City, where the former president of the United States and the leading candidate for president has just been indicted by a grand jury. And what does the prosecutor have to say? The United States attorney who prosecuted a meme guy, Douglas Mackey, for posting it's not even like a really bwa-ha-ha-ha funny meme. It was just kind of a chuckle meme. It's like, yeah, Hillary voters are dumb. I mean, they're not that dumb, but it's kind of funny. Well, he's been successfully prosecuted and convicted and faces 10 years. And the United States attorney there says, quote, today's verdict flatly rejects the perpetrator's cynical attempt to use the constitutional right of free speech as a shield for his scheme to subvert the ballot box. Talk about projection. This poor guy, Douglas Mackey, has been convicted of subverting the ballot box by the regime that perverted and subverted and corrupted the ballot box in order to steal the election in 2020 and install a sock puppet as the president. in order to rub your nose in it and just put it right in your face and mock you to your face, if you're a God-fearing, red-blooded, patriotic American, in order for the current regime to just rub your nose in it, they're going to convict this guy of doing what they just did, and they're going to send him to jail for it, if at all possible. Talk about projection. And folks, for now, you could only get a verdict like this in New York City or maybe LA, maybe San Francisco, right? But if there's not a dramatic change soon, the regime will simply forego charges or trials or verdicts. They'll just forego that altogether. And they'll just start arresting their enemies and putting them in jail without trials. Oh, wait, they're doing that already. That's right. It's like the January 6th protesters who are in jail. And I'm not talking, if there's people who broke windows or hit someone or whatever, I'm assuming they may have already been put on trial because there's actually charges easily made against them. But I'm talking about the political prisoners who are sitting in the D.C. jail right now for 2+ years. I mean, I'm thinking they're the canary in the coal mine. If the regime can pull that off, then it's just a matter of time before it's just wholesale, widespread arrest of political and cultural enemies. Because remember, this is a communist revolution that we're in the throes of. So it's not just their political enemies they want to arrest. It's their cultural enemies. And by the way, they don't just want to arrest us. They want to kill us. That's right. The arresting is just because they can't yet just publicly shoot us yet. So it starts with the arresting. Anyway, so I'm back to the home front because I'm sick of the news. I'm reading Romans simultaneously with Job on two different tracks. So I've got the weekly Bible study track where I'm going through Romans, and then I have reading the Bible with the kids at night track where we're going through Job, and it's an interesting exercise. I'm beginning to suspect that significant portions of Job are messianic in that the words of Job, particularly, and perhaps even some of the words of some of his friends are something of a record of Jesus' thoughts during his earthly ministry, and especially during his torture and his murder on the cross, his time on the cross. A lot of what's in Job is from the mind of Jesus while he was on the cross for those 6 hours. That's, anyway, so read Job with a whole different, because Job's a poem. It's not a historical narrative like other parts of the Bible. So just open yourself up to that possibility. And then finally, I read the book of Enoch. I can't tell you how many people have asked me, have you read the book of Enoch? And I've always said, well, no. Because I hadn't, because I don't know why. You only have time to read so many things. So finally I read it. And so for everyone who's asked me over the past 20 years, have you read the book of Enoch? I can finally say, yes, I read it. And so what do I think? Well, does it matter that much? I don't know, but I'll tell you. It has the feel of Jewish mystic writings that I've sampled before, of other mystic Jewish stuff that I've read. I'd even call it Nostradamic in that it's so vague as to be plastic. You can almost make just about whatever you want out of it. It does not read like the Bible. So that's the one thing I'll say categorically. It's not the Bible. And so why do I say that? So the one thing that stands out to me is that it's a book that's all about the judgment against wicked men and against wicked angels, but it never addresses sexual immorality specifically. And in the Bible, that's almost always the very first thing mentioned when wickedness and judgment are mentioned, is sexual immorality. Almost always first. And it's not addressed at all. I mean, unless you want to be like a Nostradamus guy and start twisting words and saying, well, this actually means sexual immorality. And I mean, it actually mentions the angels and what they did with the women to have the giants, but it never mentions sexual immorality specifically. So it, trust me, it's not the Bible. Anyway, as far as the Book of Enoch goes, I may address it more, maybe not, probably not. But for everyone who asked me, yes, I read it. No, it's not the Bible. I'm also reading a book from 1923. It's titled Christianity and Liberalism by J. Gresham Machen, written by J. Gresham Machen while he was the professor of New Testament at Princeton Seminary. And before he departed the increasingly liberal Princeton Cemetery, did I say? Talk about a Freudian slip. Anyway, J. Gresham Machen wrote the book before he left the increasingly liberal institution, is what I meant to say, of the Princeton Cemetery. I did it again. The Princeton Seminary. He left the Princeton Seminary in order to found the Westminster Seminary, which was more conservative. Anyway, the book is all about how liberalism, meaning, by the way, so-called liberal Christianity, is the false religion being erected against Christianity. This was written in 1923, 100 years ago. And it's interesting reading 100 years on, because now Machen does not foresee a day when Christians will be openly threatened, assaulted, beaten by demonic transgendered maniacs, like what happened in Canada this weekend, right in front of the police. I'll link to it. Check it out. It also happened in Sacramento, where the deranged trannies attacked Christians. It also happened in Texas, where transgendered maniacs physically assaulting Christians, peaceful Christians. So perhaps Machen doesn't foresee all of that. Machen, I'm sorry, or Machen, I'm not sure. Machen doesn't foresee all that. And the book, by the way, it's about doctrine. It's not really about culture or politics or anything like that. And so perhaps that was never the point. I'm sure things like that never even crossed his mind 100 years ago, that men dressed as women would be allowed to punch Christians and grab their throats in front of the police. Machen never thought that could pass. That never crossed his mind. But the title of the book is Christianity and Liberalism. And the title was taken from an article originally entitled Christianity vs. Liberalism. But apparently, in the interest of being nice, Professor Machen and his publisher went with the "and" instead of the "versus." And I'm thinking they might should have stuck with the "versus." Worldview, and I am your host and the host of the Weekly Worldview. There is no other host. Yes, perhaps the theology professor concerned with Christianity versus liberalism should have stuck with Christianity versus liberalism, versus, not and, because the two can't coexist. It's kind of like Christianity and the late great pastor Bob said that Christianity and homosexuality cannot coexist in the public square. But to put a finer point on it, open professed Christianity and open professed sexual immorality in any form cannot coexist in the public square. And Christianity's modern adversaries in the culture are not given to such niceties as assuming that perhaps we can. No, they want war. They hate us. They want to punch us in the face and kill us if they can. And they want to rape and kill our children in front of us. I mean, they're doing it right now as they have opportunity. As a father and as a man, I want to punch them in the face first. As a father and a man, I want to kill them first. As a Christian, I ask God to help me to know how to fight. Because I need some help in understanding. I'm reminded of Romans 8, where the Apostle Paul says, quote, "For thy sake, Lord, we are killed all the day long. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter," unquote. And by the way, Paul was quoting Psalm 44. So after you read the links I put up, and you see the tranny grab the throat of the Christian and punch and scratch and yell and scream and curse, and then you watch what happened in Texas, you watch what happened in Sacramento. After you watch that, I would suggest you read Psalm 44 before you form an opinion on how we fight this. And I only suggest that because that's what I'm going to do, because I'm not sure. But one thing I am, I can't really say I'm sure, but I will tell you that the massacre of Christians by a trans militant that occurred at the Covenant School, the Covenant Church, this past week, that massacre of Christians by the trans maniac is a reminder that the insurrection is actually being carried off by sex perverts versus Christians, okay? It's not Antifa versus the government, and it's not the QAnon shaman versus the Democrats. The actual insurrection that's taking place is the sex perverts versus the Christians. The sex perverts are rising up in insurrection against the Christians that have subdued such maniacal behavior for the better part of 400 years on this continent anyways. And so the sex perverts enabled that killer at the Covenant School. They enabled that maniac via their trans ideology. And then they facilitated her slaughter of the children and the old women via their celebration of suicide and their encouragement of pride, which they encourage, right? With a capital P, pride. Which, what is pride? Pride is the naked invitation to violence against normal people. That's what pride is. In the hands of the sex perverts and the trans maniacs. And the cultural elite and the free press in America are on the side of the perverts. And they're actually reproducing the perverts after their kind. The deep state, the cultural elite, the free press are reproducing sex perverts after their own kind. But the first criminal indictment of an American president could be just what we've been waiting for. Yeah, it could be just what we've been waiting for. So if the rule of law in the several states no longer applies to these suicidal maniacs, which that suicidal maniac girl who shot those kids at the church, the rule of law in the several states no longer applied to her as she carried it out and no longer applies to her now. So as far as the other suicidal sex perverts are concerned, she got away with it. She got to do what they want to do, which is kill Christians and get away with it. That's what they think. She is their icon. The law doesn't apply to her. And now the state tells us that the law, at least the rule of law in the several states, no longer applies to the highest office holder in the land. Which, by the way, the president, whether it's a former president or not, in fact, is. The president represents the highest office in the land. And what we're learning now is that the rule of law no longer applies. And we're learning it in two ways. Number one, Joe Biden is allowed to get away with criminal behavior, serial criminal behavior at the border, in the military, in the culture, from the Oval Office, issuing a statement of trans understanding and visibility the same week a tranny slaughters a bunch of Christian kids. So the law, the rule of law obviously doesn't apply to the sitting president. And now we learn that the rule of law in the several states no longer applies to the former president and the leading political front runner in the upcoming election. The rule of law no longer applies to him either. And so this is the moment that the old system has been completely suspended. And those operating the levers of political and judicial and cultural authority are now fully operating outside of the previously existing authority. It no longer exists. Or put more simply, the criminally insane sex cult working for 100 years to take down America, who installed their man in 2008 with Barack Obama and finally seized power in 2020, have now openly asserted their complete authority and the end of whatever it was before. Whatever America was before, that's over. And that was officially, finally announced this past week. That's it. And since the previously existing legal authority was usurped unlawfully, then there, in fact, is no lawful governing authority at this moment. And we find ourselves in a precarious state of anarchy, held back from an chaos by only the desire for temporal comfort among the usurpers. That's right. Those who usurped and took down the previous structure, the only thing keeping everything from exploding into violence and bloodshed is the fact that they want to be comfortable here at the moment. And they still have a desire for money and sex and comfort. That's the only thing that prevents it all from exploding, is that desire for temporal comfort among the usurpers, who, by the way, find themselves in power not by wit or wisdom or skill, but by sheer cunning and the incompetence and illegitimacy of the previous regime. That regime, by the way, includes you and me. We, the people, were supposed to be properly administering government. And we were not. But could we? No. No, in fact, we could not. The idea that the people can rule themselves is so demonstrably false, as proven through history, as to be absurd. Self-governance has been proven absurd, but we were duped into believing it, that we could do it because we were so special. We were duped into believing we could elect the nakedly ambitious to administer government for us, and that we could keep doing that for generation after generation, and that the elected and those they hire would not one day conquer us. We believed the elected and those they hired would follow the Constitution, because the Constitution is sacred. It's, nay, even divine, the Constitution. Divinely inspired. That's why they'll follow it. And it turns out that was a lie. The Constitution was always really just a lock on a door in a neighborhood free of ambitious thieves. It was a lock on a door in a neighborhood free of ambitious thieves. And as soon as the ambitious thieves were allowed to walk free in the neighborhood, they saw the unlocked lock. And they didn't see it as a sacred symbol of strength, but but as an irresistible temptation to robbery. And those ambitious thieves are now in the neighborhood at the door. The barbarians are at the gates. In fact, the barbarians already possess the gates. In fact, they stormed the gates at the Covenant School and at the State House in Nashville this past week. I'll link to that too. You can check that out. The barbarians already possess the gates. We, the people, pridefully believed the very attractive lie of the divine protection of our sacred constitution and that man could rule himself. We pridefully believe that. But to some degree, we were deceived. And so we find ourselves a lot like Adam and Eve in the garden. Guilty, yes. But perhaps to be granted some consideration due to our ignorance. Not to mention the catastrophic nature of the consequences should they all be brought to bear at once. You see, at this point, 400 years on from William Bradford at Plymouth Rock, 200 years since George Washington got down on his knees and prayed to God, there exists this catastrophic potential energy accumulated in the body politic like a stretched rubber band, like a rubber band stretched across history, held by a people so long imbibing this near religious adherence to the myth of self-government that this band is stretched as tightly as a man holds on to his religion. And as that religion is torn from the hands of those so desperate to hold on to it, the release of catastrophic energy could be measured in more blood that has been ever been spilt in any war. And so this moment is very precarious, and our immediate actions will determine our earthly fate and that of our progeny. And so I call on my fellow Americans to humble yourselves with me and admit that we were wrong, and admit that the fate of every nation must rest in the rule of a God-fearing executive, a president who proclaims the name of Jesus Christ as Savior, and who will serve at the pleasure of Jesus Christ alone, bound only by his faith to God and his signature upon a constitution that honors God and his son, Jesus Christ. Americans were uniquely blessed with executives in the past. William Bradford, right, at Plymouth Rock, George Washington, to name just two. So extraordinarily revered were these men that their spiritual influence and their fervent prayers have reverberated across the centuries. And they've subdued domestic tyrants and reproduced serviceable facsimiles of themselves across now nearly 10 generations. But now the righteous prayers of Bradford and Washington and the God-fearing men after them have all been forgotten. Or worse, they're reviled now. They're not just forgotten, they're reviled, they're hated. And so they no longer provide providence against the natural order of tyranny. And so tyranny descends upon us. Or rather, really, tyranny ascends from the pit to pull us down. This is the moment for God-fearing men to usurp the usurpers by more agile means. They deploy cunning and deception. And our earthly saviors, by the way, will assume and they'll tell us that arms must be deployed to stop them. But God-fearing men know that no political body can be put above loyalty to God. And instead of joining the carnal fray, we must, by calm and fervent loyalty to God, appeal to God before all men. Out in public, we need to pray for his mercy and guidance that peace might prevail and save our souls and the souls of our children. And perhaps, but not as importantly, restore an order in which men might flourish on the earth again. Perhaps, if we humble ourselves. And so, I suppose I should probably just end on that. Is there anything more that can be said? Well, I guess I'll read this. Well, I'll read this from the Washington Times about spiritual crisis. Poll after poll shows our rapid descent into oblivion. This is from the Kings and Chronicles folder. If you've read Kings and Chronicles, you know. Polls show that we're in a descent. In just 25 years, Americans have largely abandoned the connective tissues and values that once offered unity of sorts with patriotism and religion. And those values are plunging. That's right. The latest poll, 38% said patriotism was important. 39% religion. And having children, 30%. 30% of the people polled find that important. And we're reminded in the article that the Wall Street Journal first reported these numbers back in 1998. In 1998, 70% said patriotism was important. 62% said religion. And in 1998, 59% said having children was important. And I was not on the air in 1998, but I was working for a man who was on the air in 1998. And I remember this poll in 1998. And I remember the late, great Bob Enyart on his, I believe it was his TV show in 1998, apoplectic about the numbers in 1998. Shocked that only 62% thought religion was important. He was shocked that less than 60% now of people thought having children was important. And Bob Enyart said, this is the harbinger of the end of the age of America. This is the end of the country, folks. He said 25 years ago in 1998, and here we are now, 30 years hence. And so The fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. And so, and I know the late, great Bob Enyart prayed. And I'm going to ask all you to pray, and we will all pray. And we'll look to God. And should the Lord tarry, we'll return next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you. And may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.